In my Christmas message today, I'd like to return to a theme that I've spoken about previously in Christmas messages. That is the central and crucial identification of the arrival of Jesus as the light of the world. Here we are on December 24th, 3 days after the winter solstice, and already, I'm sure, you, like me, are anticipating more daylight. Minute by minute, we eagerly await the return of longer days and shorter nights, along with the vitality and warmth and life that light brings. So light in the scriptures becomes a profoundly meaningful metaphor for what Jesus represents. In Luke 1, verse 76 to 79, we read that Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, was, quote, filled with and under the control of the Holy Spirit when he prophesied the following. It reads, "And you, little one," that is Zechariah referring to his own baby, John the Baptist, "you shall be called a prophet of the Most High, for you will go on before the face of the Lord to make ready his way, to bring and give the knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness and remission of their sins. And because of the tender mercy and loving kindness of our God, a light from on high will dawn upon us and visit us to shine upon and give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shade of death, to direct and guide our feet in a straight line into the way of peace." There's no ambiguity here whatsoever. The author of Luke's gospel is very clearly presenting the soon-to-be-born Jesus as a direct vehicle through whom the light of God will shine upon the darkness within the world. But what is that light, and how does it function in the world? Is Jesus some kind of holy illumination or beacon to show people where to walk in order to find peace? Is the arrival of Jesus some sort of light that points back to the one who sent him? Does the reference to light include some suggestion of hope and rescue and deliverance? Well, yes, these symbols are functions of the prophecy, but without the context from the First Testament, since Jesus is said to be fulfilling the law and the prophets in his ministry, without the First Testament explanation of light from on high, we cannot understand the full intent of the meaning of that phrase. From the beginning of Israel's history as a people, as the children of Yahweh, they were expected to be an example of what it would look like when people faithfully followed the true God. That is, they were called to be a reflection of the light that would bring blessing to all nations. Isaiah 42, verse 5 to 7. "This is what God the Lord says, the creator of heavens, who stretches them out and spreads out the earth with all that springs from it, who gives breath to his people and life to those who walk on it. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness, and I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you, and I will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light to the Gentiles," illuminating the way ahead, the way to go, the way to be, to open the eyes that are blind to the identity of the true God, to free captives from emotional, psychological, and spiritual prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. So based on the preceding and the succeeding verses of Isaiah, which I'm not going to read, it's obvious that this is not a messianic prophecy. It is often quoted as one, but this is not a messianic prophecy. Isaiah is talking about the nation of Israel as a whole being used to bless the world. But the key to understanding the prophecy is that while Israel is being informed that God, through them, will somehow free captives from prison, they themselves are presently exiled from their homeland, held captive in Babylon. So they need to get themselves out of prison before they can release anyone else. And since being in prison is equated to darkness, they too are missing the light that they must show to others. Religion in the ancient world was very much a regional thing. There was a sense that God was with the Jewish people in Israel. Being in captivity in Assyria or Babylon or anywhere else meant that they had left God behind and desired eagerly to go back to Him. They had no temple, they had no altar, there were no sacrifices. There was no way for them to connect to God directly. So they needed to get themselves out of prison first. Prophecies and metaphors of subjugation and restoration were, as one might imagine, rather popular during a time of forced exile. When the temple had been destroyed, when the Jewish people were without a homeland, the Jews felt like, we know it's not true, but they felt like they had no hope. They were utterly powerless. They certainly couldn't raise an army to defeat their captors. Isaiah in chapter 30, verse 26 says that someday in the future, when Israel is restored to its rightful place of blessing and honor, the moon will shine like the sun. That's a pretty profound metaphor. The moon doesn't shine like the sun. The moon is a small reflection, a little tiny flashlight in the sky. But this is the extent to which Israel's light will shine, even though now they have no light. Again, this was of great encouragement, and that was the reason for the prophecy from Isaiah, to give the people a sense of hope. The moon will shine like the sun, and the sunlight will be 7 times brighter than what it normally is. Like the light of 7 full days when the Lord binds up the bruises of His people and heals the wounds of the afflicted. So light is equated with healing, with abundance, with blessing and joy and honor and peace and prosperity to the highest degree possible, along with and because of their direct reconnection with God. And it is because He is with them and has accepted them that the people are in the light. For the Jewish people in exile, their new pagan Babylonian environment, including the culture, the ethics, and the religion of their captors, was thought of in terms of darkness and depression. Isaiah 59, verse 9 expresses this sense of hopelessness. He writes, "Justice is far from us, and darkness does not reach, righteousness rather, does not reach us. We look for light, we want light, we hope for light, but all, everything is utter darkness. We look for brightness, but we walk in deep shadows." But the captives are encouraged by Isaiah's promise that despite their current dilemma, nations, he writes, will ultimately come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. So these prophecies are not messianic. They're for Israel. They're for a message of hope. For now, you don't have light. You don't see what's coming. But I want to let you know that someday you will be restored. Someday you will be great. Someday people will come to you because of your light. But you can already see how these themes then are reimagined and reignited in the life and ministry of Jesus. But if Isaiah is speaking to Jews in Babylonian captivity about freedom and restoration as part of a covenant promise, what does this have to do with Jesus? If these are not directly messianic prophecies, if they're referring to Israel, does this have any, and how is it connected to Jesus? Well, early in his ministry, after being tempted in the wilderness by Satan, which affirmed his readiness to take on the task of salvation ministry and sacrifice, Jesus left Nazareth and moved to Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali. And Luke says this was done to fulfill what was said by the prophet Isaiah. Now, it's quite interesting that often when we hear this was done to fulfill something from the Old Testament, it's not an exact reproduction of what the prophet said. In Matthew 4:16, it says, "The land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned." Now, that's not an exact quote from Isaiah, but it fulfills the intent of the message. So it's not that Jesus fulfilled what Isaiah said. It's that Jesus is a new expression, a higher expression of the fulfillment in Isaiah's time. So the people hearing what Matthew is writing know exactly what he's referring to. They recall in their history when their ancestors were in captivity in Babylon, when they were given the hope that someday they would be restored and they would be released from captivity and they would rebuild the temple and become God's people again and be a light in their nation. They remembered that that happened. But now they are hearing that this is going to jump ahead hundreds of years to this time, to these people in Galilee living in darkness. There's a new way in which light is going to be expressed. What Isaiah had said was that there's coming a time when there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. And this is the message of the coming of Jesus. In the past, Isaiah 9 verse 1 actually says this: "In the past, the Lord humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea, beyond Jordan." So very similar, but not quite the same. In verse 4, he explains that when a light appears, both the, quote, yoke of bondage, that is the bar across their shoulder — this is agricultural terminology for the yoking of two oxen together — when that burden is lifted and the weapon of punishment of their oppressors would be shattered. So there's coming relief. And then Isaiah says in verse 6, now I want you to remember, this is not a messianic prophecy, but it is used as a messianic prophecy, and certainly at the Christmas season, this is used to describe the coming of Jesus. In verse 6, it said, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders." We're so used to hearing that being Jesus that we forget, or we may not be aware, that that is a reinvention of that fulfillment of that prophecy. Let me read it again. Isaiah is saying to people in exile in Babylon, "For to us, you and me, a child is born, has already been born. To us, a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. This is a statement about what has already begun to happen to the Jews in captivity, the people hearing Isaiah. And if you ask any Jew, they will immediately recognize that the child born to us was primarily understood to be the infant Hezekiah, who would grow up to be one of Israel's greatest kings. So what Matthew is doing is making an incredible claim that when he's making a connection between King Hezekiah and Jesus, but not as equals. Matthew's gospel is saying that when Jesus moved to Capernaum, he was doing so in order to reveal the light of blessing and joy and peace and prosperity to those people. In other words, he's bringing freedom from captivity. But the Jews in Galilee are not in captivity. They are under the control of the Roman government, but they're free to move around. They can leave the country. They can go anywhere they want. So he's talking about something else, something beyond what Isaiah was talking about, something beyond what the Jews in captivity experienced in their freedom. And he's also making the claim that Jesus, as a representative of all Israel, is going to fulfill the promise of Isaiah beyond, far beyond what Hezekiah was ever able to do. So Matthew's author is connecting Jesus with being the human instrument through whom God would bring hope and healing and honor and renewal in the place of shame and hopelessness, wherever it is found. And that renewal and honor would be experienced as the warming, illuminating, life-giving light of a new revelation of God and a new and prosperous and peaceful future. And then only a few passages later, Jesus tells his disciples, guess what? You are the light of the world. You are the ones who are to illuminate, to bring healing, righteousness, restoration, peace, everything that I represent. He says a town built on a hill can't be hidden. It's built there partly for defensive reasons, but it's also there so that everyone can see them. And in every village and every town and city in Europe, the churches are built on the hills. You should be able to see where the church is in any part of the country. He says, so then let your light shine. So there's light in you, or at least a reflection of the true light, but you have to let it out. It doesn't come out by itself. You can bottle it up. Let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So Jesus is directly transferring the responsibility of bringing justice, righteousness, peace, prosperity, that is in the sense of well-being, not in the sense of wealth, and a new relationship to a covenant God to his followers, to his students, those who accepted his gospel and wish to participate in his grace movement. It's not that Jesus stopped being the light bearer, but he cannot do it alone or chooses not to do it alone, and his movement is one of viral transformation from God to Jesus, from Jesus to us, and from us to the rest of the world. We now are the ongoing fulfillment of Isaiah. We are now the light bearers of God's light from Christ to bring a message of freedom to those held captive by sin and destruction.